Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Thursday, the 18th of October 2012, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. This is episode 57 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality, and we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each show we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to look at the question commonly debated between atheists and believers: can we be good without God? And we'll give you the Reality Check take on this much-discussed topic. Then, in our movie review, we'll have a look at two new American films, Bernie and Looper. So for all that and more, stay tuned here to Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Now, before I get into our LGBT news roundup, I just want to give a quick plug for the upcoming Australian Skeptics National Convention, coming up here in Melbourne from November 30th to December 2nd. There's going to be loads of exciting speakers, including James Randi, DJ Grothy, Brian Thompson, Rebecca Watson, Lawrence Leung, Dr. Ken Harvey, and many more. I've got my ticket already, and it looks like it's going to be a really fun, inspiring, and enlightening event. So if this sounds like your cup of tea and you'd like to get a ticket, just Google Vic Skeptics and there you can buy your ticket on the website. So hopefully I'll see you there at the end of November. Now, here's our LGBT news roundup since the last episode of Reality Check, back on February 26th, so that's covering the last, well, almost 8 months. And let me say straight out, I'm only going to cover the good news stories, because, well, the bad news stories, there are always bad news stories, and they're pretty much always the same. Okay, let me quickly give you the bad news in a nutshell. LGBT people continue to be discriminated against, humiliated, reviled, arrested, incarcerated, beaten up, tortured, and murdered all over the world simply for existing. So that's the bad news, and it's pretty much been the same for the last few centuries. But the fact that there's now some good news as well is what's really new and different and sets our current era apart from previous eras. And it shows that we're living through an historic period of social and cultural change taking place worldwide. So, what is the good news for these last few months? Well, happily, there's quite a bit of it. Let's head first to Geneva and follow what's been happening regarding LGBT rights at the United Nations Human Rights Council, because this is a subject that we've been following closely here on Reality Check over the last few episodes. So just to recap, dear listener, First of all, in June last year, 2011, the UN Human Rights Council passed an historic resolution for the first time ever on human rights, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Now, that resolution, as well as expressing grave concern about violations of LGBT rights around the world, also ordered two things to happen. One was a study to be released in December last year, examining discrimination against LGBT people around the world. And the second thing was to hold a panel discussion on LGBT rights at the UN Human Rights Council in March this year. So, in our last episode of Reality Check, we reported on the release of that study, which, surprise, surprise, found that there is widespread discrimination and violence against LGBT people worldwide. But what we haven't reported on yet is what happened at that UN panel discussion in March. So, how did it go? Did the nations of the world accept the results of the study and vow to combat discrimination and violence against LGBT people wherever they encounter it? Well, some of them did, but the most notable thing about the event was that as the discussion was just starting to get underway, almost all the delegates from the Islamic and African countries stood up and walked out. The panel discussion went ahead anyway, but with a large number of empty seats in the council chamber. Now, that's not very constructive, is it? Oh, well, I suppose it's better than if they'd all just put their fingers in their ears and said, "La la 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 la, I can't hear you, la 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 la." Still, it's not a very hopeful sign, that kind of behaviour. But let's focus on the positive and remember that this is the first time ever that the UN has dealt with LGBT rights issues. So we are making progress, even if it seems at a glacial pace. And I have to say that both the current UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, have been the most strenuous and outspoken advocates for LGBT rights ever to hold those offices. So although the walkout at the panel discussion in Geneva was disappointing, I think we can take heart in the fact that a panel discussion took place at all, and that two of the highest officials in the United Nations are such unwavering and outspoken advocates for our cause. I think that gives us grounds for hope. And as we always say here on Reality Check, we live in historic times, dear listener. History is being made every day when it comes to advances in LGBT rights, and we're seeing that happening at the United Nations right now. All right, so that's the UN out of the way. Let's move on now to our favourite topic here at Reality Check, and let's see what's happened in the steady and inevitable march towards same-sex marriage around the world. And I'm sure it will come as no surprise, dear listener, to learn that since February, there have been a number of very exciting developments in the field of marriage equality, including two new jurisdictions that opened up marriage to same-sex couples. One a country and one a state. Now, do you know what they were, dear listener? Can you remember? Well, let me tell you. The country that achieved marriage equality within the last 8 months was Denmark. A same-sex marriage bill was approved by the parliament there on June 7th and came into force on June 15th, making Denmark now the 11th country in the world to allow same-sex marriage nationally. Of course, two more countries, Mexico and the United States, allow same-sex marriage in some regions, but not throughout the country as a whole. So a big congratulations to all our Reality Check listeners in Denmark. Of course, Denmark is a very special country in terms of LGBT rights because it was the first country in the world to introduce registered partnerships for same-sex couples back in 1989. So now, finally, 23 years later, they've moved on to full marriage equality. So it took a while, but I'm happy to report that they finally made it in the end. So Denmark was the country to achieve marriage equality in these last few months, but what was the other jurisdiction? Well, dear listener, if you know the answer to that, I'll be very impressed, because this place slipped almost completely under the radar and almost nobody noticed that suddenly it had become the latest jurisdiction in the world to allow same-sex marriage. And the place I'm talking about is the state of Quintana Roo in Mexico, meaning that same-sex marriages are now performed in two jurisdictions in Mexico, Mexico City and Quintana Roo. And by law, those marriages are recognized in all of the other 30 states of the Mexican Republic. So congratulations to all our Reality Check listeners in Quintana Roo. Felicitaciones, chicos. Now, in case you're wondering where exactly Quintana Roo is located, well, it's basically the state at the tip of the Yucatan Peninsula facing onto the Caribbean Sea. And the biggest city there is Cancun. So if you've ever gone on vacation to Cancun, then you've been to Quintana Roo, maybe without even realizing it. As to how Quintana Roo actually got marriage equality, well, the story is a little bit complicated with a lot of pressure from LGBT activists, but basically in the end, it was by order of the executive. On the 3rd of May, the state government announced that from now on, all registry offices in the state are now obliged to perform same-sex marriages. So just like that, Quintana Roo became the latest domino to fall in the great global movement towards marriage equality. And now, sensing an opportunity, the government of Quintana Roo wants to promote the state internationally as a wedding destination for same-sex couples. So, dear listener, don't be surprised if you see a lot of same-sex weddings taking place in Cancun and along the Riviera Maya over the coming months. Maybe you'll even be lucky enough to get invited to one. That would be cool. So, Denmark and Quintana Roo were the two jurisdictions to actually achieve marriage equality in the last few months. But there have been a lot of exciting steps taken towards marriage equality in a number of other places as well. And perhaps the most significant is what's been happening in France. Now, unless you've been hiding under a rock for the last 8 months, you'll know that in May, the Socialist Party candidate François Hollande won the presidential election and became president of France. And even more important, in June, his party also won an absolute majority in the National Assembly. And what's extremely exciting is that François Hollande and the Socialist Party went to the polls promising to introduce same-sex marriage if they were elected. And now that they've been elected, they are proceeding with plans to introduce marriage equality by early 2013, next year. So, dear listener, it's looking highly, highly likely that France will be, if not the next, then one of the next countries to introduce same-sex marriage within the next few months. Meaning that France will be the first of the traditional great powers to achieve marriage equality at the national level. And I think that will be a very significant development, and one that will hopefully speed up the pace of reform in the rest of Europe. Indeed, in the rest of the world, hopefully. Now, apart from France, the other major earthquake of the last few months was, of course, President Obama's announcement on May 9th that he now supports marriage equality. This was perhaps the most exciting news I've heard in quite some time. And just like that, Obama became the first US president in history to support marriage equality. So, as I keep saying, dear listener, we are living in exciting times, and every episode of Reality Check, we are witnessing history being made. We are right in the middle of a major social change happening throughout the Western world, and Obama's announcement, I think, is a major and historic turning point in that process. Now, here's an interesting fact for you, dear listener. Looking around now at the main countries of the, well, the so-called Anglosphere, that is the major industrialized English-speaking democracies, most of their leaders now support same-sex marriage. Obama supports it in the US. Canada already has marriage equality. David Cameron supports it in the UK. John Key supports it in New Zealand. And of course, I should add that both Cameron and Key are conservative politicians. And if you want to throw South Africa into the mix as well, well, it already has marriage equality, like Canada. So, in fact, the only leader of that group who doesn't support marriage equality is our own Julia Gillard, the unmarried atheist Labour Prime Minister. It's a little bit ridiculous, isn't it? And frankly, Julia, if you're listening, I think history is going to judge you harshly for that. Anyway, the mention of John Key in New Zealand brings us to another exciting development in the global march towards marriage equality. And that is that John Key, the conservative Prime Minister of New Zealand, the leader of the National Party, supports same-sex marriage. And progress is being made. A same-sex marriage bill was introduced into the New Zealand Parliament in July. And on August 29th, it was passed at its first reading with a vote of 80 to 40. It'll go back for a second reading early next year, apparently, so it's looking highly possible that New Zealand may very well be one of the next countries to get same-sex marriage. It might even beat France to the draw. We'll just have to wait and see. Meanwhile, the same-sex marriage debate continues to rage in the UK, with consultations into the issue currently underway in England and Wales. And with the Scottish Government completing its consultation in July and announcing straight away that it intends to introduce marriage equality in Scotland within the coming months. So things are definitely moving ahead quickly now in many parts of the world. And just before we finish our marriage roundup, let's have a quick look at the latest development in the United States on that front. Because back in February, we reported here on Reality Check that the legislatures of both the states of Maryland and Washington had passed bills to open up marriage to same-sex couples. But that if opponents gathered enough signatures, both those laws would be put to the ballot in November. Well, unfortunately, as predicted, opponents in both those states did gather enough signatures, so both laws will be voted on November the 6th, the day of the presidential elections. So November 6th is actually going to be the most important day for marriage equality in the history of the United States so far. Because not only will voters decide the issue directly in Maryland and Washington, but also in the state of Maine as well. Because in Maine, the proponents of same-sex marriage gathered enough signatures to put the issue on the ballot there. So it's quite possible that on November 6th, three states could achieve marriage equality all on the same day, depending on what the voters decide. That would be unprecedented. So keep your fingers crossed, dear listener. It's only less than 3 weeks away now. Now, it should be noted that until now, voters in the United States have never approved of same-sex marriage when it was put to the ballot. But that will have to change eventually, so let's hope it happens this November. And, of course, keep your fingers crossed that Obama is re-elected on the same day, because whatever else you want to say about the Republicans and the Democrats, on the issue of LGBT rights, they are like chalk and cheese. The Democratic Party now officially supports marriage equality in its platform. The Republicans are officially hostile to any advance in LGBT rights. The difference is quite dramatic. So, fingers crossed. Marriage equality in three states and Obama re-elected all at once. That would be a great way to wake up on November 7th. Let's hope so. So that's what's been happening around the world regarding marriage equality over the last few months. But what about what's been happening here in Australia? Well, the issue has been progressing in a certain way, and in fact, history has been made. That's because on August 30th, just 6 weeks ago or so, the lower house of the Parliament of Tasmania became the first legislative chamber in Australian history to pass a bill allowing same-sex marriage. The vote was 13 to 11, with all the Liberal Party MPs voting against it and one Labor MP joining them. But there were still enough votes from the Greens and the other Labor MPs to get it through. So that was historic and exciting. The not-so-exciting part, however, is that on September 27th, the bill was voted down in the upper house, 8-6. They came so close, but no cigar, unfortunately. However, there is now similar same-sex marriage legislation being considered in South Australia, the ACT, and New South Wales. So it still might be possible that we get to see marriage equality somewhere in Australia in the coming months. Who knows? Now, I know that you may find this Tasmanian development a bit confusing, dear listener, because, of course, in Australia, unlike the United States or Canada or Mexico, marriage is a federal issue, not a state issue. So how can a state be legislating for same-sex marriage? Well, because, according to some constitutional experts, if the federal parliament fails to legislate on the issue, then the power falls to the states. Of course, the legality of this is far from clear, so if the bill does get through a state parliament, the Commonwealth will almost certainly take legal action in the High Court to determine the constitutionality of the whole deal. Of course, such an expensive and time-consuming legal case would be completely unnecessary if the Commonwealth just enacted marriage equality itself, so it would then apply to the whole country. But, of course, our federal politicians are not that smart, because I'm sure you heard, dear listener, the disappointing news that a bill to allow same-sex marriage at the federal level was voted down in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. On September 19th, the House of Reps voted against it 98-42. And the following day, the Senate voted against it 41-26. The Labor Party MPs were allowed a conscience vote, and I'm pleased to say that most of them voted in favour of marriage equality, as did all the Greens, of course, and the independent MPs Rob Oakeshott, Andrew Wilkie, Craig Thompson, and Nick Xenophon in the Senate. So kudos to them. The Liberal National Coalition, however, did not allow its members a conscience vote, and so all of them voted against the bill, dooming it to failure. What nasty, nasty people. And not just nasty, but in my opinion, immoral. I think the Coalition and the Labor MPs who voted against the bill acted immorally. There, they had before them a bill that would give rights to hundreds of thousands of people, make those people very happy, would cost nothing, and would take nothing away from anyone. In other words, a bill that would only increase general happiness at no cost to anyone. And they voted against it. Now that is just vicious, mean, and immoral. I just hope that they're still alive in 30 or 40 years' time when people look back and see what they did and judge them as the narrow-minded bigots that they are. All right, now that I've got that out of my system, to finish off our news roundup, let's return to the United States quickly and have a look at what's going on with the two big LGBT issues there that we've been following here on Reality Check. Well, following since we began back in 2009, in fact. They are DOMA and Proposition 8. Well, of course, we used to also be following Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but that was abolished last year. So that's history now, thank goodness. And even Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan have said they won't bring it back if they win office. So thankfully, that's gone for good. But what about those other two issues, DOMA and Proposition 8? Well, they're both issues that are still very much unresolved. So let's see what's happening with them. Now, DOMA is the Defense of Marriage Act, passed in 1996. And basically what it does is it prohibits the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages. Even perfectly legal same-sex marriages performed in states that allow them, like New York. There have been several legal cases brought against DOMA in the US federal courts, and these have gradually been working their way, percolating up through the federal court system. The Obama administration began by defending DOMA in those cases, but in February last year it announced that it would no longer do so. It continues to enforce DOMA because it's legally obliged to obey the law, supposedly, but it has stated that it believes DOMA to be unconstitutional and so will not defend it in court. The Republicans in the House of Representatives, however, have stepped in and appointed their own lawyers to defend DOMA in all those court cases that are currently underway. And 7 times now, different courts in the federal court system have found DOMA to be unconstitutional. In other words, in all the DOMA decisions of the last few years, it's never been upheld by the courts. It's always been struck down, which is wonderful news because DOMA is a very nasty piece of legislation. Most recently, in May this year, a federal appeals court in Boston with a panel of 3 judges unanimously found DOMA to be unconstitutional. And what's happened most recently is that there are now 5 cases that have been gradually progressing up through the federal courts. They're cases originating in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and California. And those 5 cases have now been kind of clumped together, and those 5 have all now been appealed directly to the U.S. Supreme Court in an effort to resolve the constitutionality of DOMA once and for all, with a decision straight from the top. Now, we don't know yet if the Supreme Court will accept those cases, but it seems likely that it probably will, and so we should have a final definitive decision on the constitutionality of DOMA once and for all within the next few months. Let's hope it's struck down. But whatever happens, dear listener, you know you'll hear about it here on Reality Check. Okay, so that's DOMA, hopefully an issue soon to be resolved, but what about Proposition 8? Well, it also looks like it might be on the point of some kind of resolution. Prop 8 is the ballot proposal that was approved by the voters of California in 2008 that banned same-sex marriage in California, just a few months after it had been allowed by the state Supreme Court. So, just like with DOMA, a legal case against the constitutionality of Proposition 8 has been slowly moving its way through the US federal court system, and is now also about to arrive at the US Supreme Court, to be decided once and for all. And just like with DOMA, we still don't know whether the court is going to accept the case or not. If it decides not to take the case, then same-sex marriages will finally be able to resume in California after a hiatus of 4 years. And that could happen within days or weeks from the time you hear this podcast, dear listener. If, on the other hand, the Supreme Court does decide to hear the case, then we could have to wait a few more months for a definitive verdict. But once again, dear listener, whatever happens, you will certainly hear about it here on Reality Check. And with that, dear listener, we come to the end of our LGBT news roundup for the period covering February to October 2012. Let's take a quick break now and listen to a song, and when we come back, we'll tackle religion head on and try to answer the question, can we be good without God? So don't go away. Much more Reality Check coming up here on Joy 94.9.
Bonjour, c'est Tina René. Vous écoutez La Joie 94.9. Darling.
Come with us as we take you to all new heights. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Las Pequeñas Cosas by Mexican pop group Hot Dog. Okay, we now move into the part of the show where we normally undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. But today we're going to do something slightly different. Although still related to the supernatural, we're going to tackle religion head on and ask the question, can we be good without God? Or another way of putting it, why should we be good if there are no gods? Now, I was inspired to talk about this topic today after attending the second Global Atheist Convention held in Melbourne in March this year. I was also lucky enough to attend the first convention back in 2010, an event that we reported on here on Reality Check. And I'm pleased to say that the second one was just as interesting and inspiring as the first. The lineup of speakers included Daniel Dennett, Peter Singer, Richard Dawkins, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor, P.Z. Myers, Ayan Hirsi Ali, Lawrence Krauss, and many, many others. A truly world-class lineup. I've got to say kudos to the organizers for pulling off now two fantastic conventions. The highlight of this year's convention was, in my opinion, the talk by the American philosopher and neuroscientist Sam Harris. While most of the other speakers dealt with topics like combating the influence of religion in schools and religion in politics and things like that, which are all interesting topics, what I really liked about Sam Harris's talk is that he got straight to the heart of the matter and dealt with what is kind of like one of the big elephants in the room when it comes to atheism, and that is, being atheists, how do we cope with death? How can we cope with the fact that death is the end? There's no heaven or hell, no afterlife, no continuing existence of consciousness on some other plane. Just eternal oblivion, which is, in my opinion, probably the fundamental question that atheists have to face. And yet, in the atheist free-thinking community, we don't really hear it talked about that much. So that's what I enjoyed about Sam Harris's talk. He wasn't talking about peripheral issues, but one of the key issues at the heart of atheism. And actually, for most believers, for non-atheists, it's normally the first thing they think about when they meet an atheist. It's often the first question they really want to ask. You don't believe in God? That's awful! So what do you think happens when you die? You just rot away in the ground? Well, yeah, that's what we think. But surprisingly enough, as atheists, we don't really talk about it much amongst ourselves. Anyway, what I want to do today is kind of try to do something like what Sam Harris did and jump directly to another key issue at the heart of atheism. And what I want to talk about is not so much how to deal with death if you don't believe in God, but how to deal with life if you don't believe in God. How to act. What moral code to live by, if any, if you don't believe in a God, or gods. When you hear this issue discussed in formal public debates, it's normally formulated as the question, can we be good without God? And that's the question I want to try to answer today, to give you the official reality check answer to this much debated question. Now, over the years, I've heard a number of debates between atheists and believers on this topic, but all in my mind have been somewhat unsatisfactory. They generally devolve into atheists pointing out all the horrible moral examples depicted in the Bible, and believers pointing out examples of wonderful things that specific Christians or other believers have done. Or else they start comparing atrocities committed by atheist regimes with those committed by religious zealots. But all that pretty much misses the point, in my opinion. So, enough of the preamble, let's get into it. Can we be good without God? Well, first I'll give a trite answer to that question. Of course we can be good without God. In fact, everyone who has ever been good without God because there is no God. So, everyone in the history of the world who has ever acted in a good or altruistic, selfless way has done so necessarily without God. Question resolved. End of discussion. Of course, that answer is disingenuous because obviously when people ask the question, can we be good without God? What they really mean is, can people be good without a belief in God? Or another way of putting it, can people be good if they don't believe that there's an invisible supernatural entity watching over their shoulder and judging them for their actions? Well, again, the answer to this question is pretty straightforward. Of course people can be good even if they don't believe in God. We have overwhelming empirical evidence of this. Just go along to the Global Atheist Convention, for example. Were those thousands of atheists there robbing, raping, and murdering each other just because they believed that no God was watching? As far as I recall, no, they weren't. In fact, believe it or not, everyone was actually quite respectful of each other. I don't even think there were any reports of pickpockets, let alone murderers. And do atheists donate money to charities or spend time doing voluntary work in their communities? Well, yes, they do, in large numbers. Millions of people are, in fact, good without a belief in God. So obviously, yes, we can be good without God. Again, question resolved, end of discussion. Okay, well, again, I think that's a pretty superficial answer to the question, obviously. Even though it's at that level that it seems a lot of those public debates end up, comparing how much good or evil atheists do in the world compared to believers. But again, I think that's missing the point, because I think what the question is really getting at is, why should you be good if you don't believe in God? If you don't believe that any kind of deity is watching you and evaluating you? Is there any reason to be good if you don't believe you're being observed by a higher power? Well, yes, sometimes there are rational reasons to be good, to help other people. Maybe this develops relationships with people that will be of use to you in the future. There could, in fact, be all kinds of rational reasons why it might be in your own self-interest to assist other people, to be good to them. But what about when there are no rational reasons to be good to another person? When it's not in your self-interest to help someone else? When you could, in fact, gain by harming someone else? Why should you not do it? What about if you're in a remote place, say, and some guy walks by carrying all his valuables? And for the purposes of this hypothetical, let's imagine that you have a gun and you could kill that guy and take his valuables without ever being caught. Now, isn't it rational for you to take that course of action? Well, in the debates I've seen, atheists tend to respond to this proposal in a very reasonable way by saying, well, duh, hello, what planet do you live on? Atheists are human beings too, with feelings like all human beings, and we don't want to rob and rape and murder people. We don't need belief in God to stop us killing people for our own benefit. We just don't want to. Our conscience tells us it's wrong. And for most of us, we would find it abhorrent and traumatic and completely against our nature. And so, in fact, the thought never even occurs to us. And I would say that that reason applies equally to believers as well as atheists. The reason most believers don't kill a stranger to rob him of all his possessions, even if they could get away with it, is because they don't want to. They would find it abhorrent on a psychological level, just like an atheist would. I mean, it's not that a believer actually wants to kill people but decides not to because they think that God is watching. I mean, the reason that neither atheists nor believers murder strangers to take their belongings is because, well, for someone who's grown up in a relatively peaceful and ordered society, it's just something that would be a horrific and traumatic thing to do, and it really never occurs to them. All right, okay, well, yes, obviously no one except a psychopath wants to murder someone just to steal their possessions. But let's try to think of another example where maybe the idea of a supernatural being watching you may seem to become more relevant. What if you're sitting quietly on a suburban train and there's a woman sitting a few seats away from you? Now, you don't know her, you've never seen her before, and you'll never see her again once she leaves the train. And there's hardly anyone else in the carriage. The train stops at a station and the woman gets up and starts to walk towards the door to leave the train. And you suddenly notice that, unbeknownst to her, her wallet has slipped out of her handbag onto the seat. And it's got a lot of $100 notes sticking out of it. So she's left it accidentally on the seat and is walking off the train, oblivious to what's happened. Let's also imagine, just for the purposes of the hypothetical, that there are no cameras on the train and no one around to see what you're doing. So you face the choice. Alert the woman that she's left her wallet behind so she can quickly run back for it and then get off the train expressing her eternal gratitude to you for your kindness. Or you can stay silent. Wait until the woman gets off the train and then help yourself to the cash and whatever other valuables you might find inside. And this kind of scenario, I think, touches on the key issue inherent in the question. Should we be good without God in that situation? Well, I think as atheists, we shouldn't be afraid to tackle the question head on. And so, in a debate with Christians, for example, we shouldn't be afraid to say, well, as atheists, we don't believe we'll be judged by some invisible deity. And so, if we can get away with it without anyone finding out, then actually, there's no rational reason to be good in those circumstances. There's no rational reason to act selflessly in the interests of a stranger. For example, in the train situation, it is in my rational interest to let the woman get off and to help myself to her belongings. From a purely rational point of view, that's the right self-interested thing to do. However, and this is the point we need to make to believers, Just because you're an atheist doesn't mean you have to always act in a purely rational, self-interested way. Because, surprise, surprise, as I already mentioned, we atheists have emotions as well. And we have a conscience, and we have empathy for other people, and sympathy, and we feel good when we help someone, and we often act selflessly to help others, even if that may not be what purely rational self-interest might dictate. Because, dear listener, I know that I, and most likely you too, would, in that train situation, call out to the woman or even pick up her wallet and hand it to her. Why? Well, not because God is watching, but because we have a conscience. We try to do what's right, even if it's not rational. Because, basically, we feel better about ourselves. We're able to look at ourselves in the mirror. That's why. Not for religious reasons, not for rational reasons, but for purely emotional, psychological reasons. But, say the believers, that's all very well for you, but what about other people? What about the masses? And this is something that I think does trouble many believers. They think, isn't it dangerous to promote free thinking and atheism? Because if people stop believing that God is watching them, then maybe they'll be more inclined to let the woman get off the train and help themselves to her belongings. How do you know that they'll have a conscience just because you do? How do you know they'll have the same psychological and emotional makeup that would make them act in a selfless way? Isn't it better to scare them into thinking that God is monitoring them 24 hours a day to keep them under control? Isn't that better for the good of society? Well, no. I mean, just because believers think that God is watching doesn't mean they're all going to be good and give the woman her wallet. Because we all know how religion works, and religion can be used to justify pretty much any kind of behavior you want. So I have no doubt that some believers would be able to find some religious justification to keep the wallet. Some reason why God brought this wonderful fortuitous opportunity into my life. Oh, I guess God made that woman leave her handbag behind because he knew that I needed this money more than her. How convenient! In fact, how many times has religion been used to justify truly, truly evil acts over the course of history? Well, many, many times. So, belief in God is certainly no guarantee that people will be good. And I suspect that, in fact, there would be very little difference between the percentage of believers and the percentage of atheists who returned the wallet to the woman. I mean, ultimately, I suspect that most believers would act in the same way as most atheists and would give the wallet to the woman for the same emotional reasons. Not because they think God is watching, but for reasons of conscience. I mean, it's not that believers actually want to take the money but think that God will get angry if they do. Or if it is like that, I suspect it's a tiny minority of believers who actually feel that way. It would be interesting, actually, to do an experiment to find out if there is a difference between believers and atheists in these kinds of situations. To perform that little train scenario on hundreds of people and compare the two groups. I mean, it would also be interesting to do it in dozens of countries in different cultures and compare them. I'm sure there'd probably be quite substantial differences between countries and probably differences between classes within a country. But I doubt that there'd be much difference between believers and atheists. Because I suspect that the factors that determine your moral conscience are much more dependent on culture and class than they are on religious belief. Well, it would be interesting to do an experiment to work it out. I don't think such an experiment has been done. If you know of one, dear listener, please let us know. Now, in fact, this kind of experiment reminds me of one called the Lost Letter Experiment. And this was research carried out in London that was actually recently discussed on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. What the researchers did was they left hundreds of so-called lost letters on the footpath in various neighbourhoods to see what percentage of people would pick up the letter and pop it into a mailbox. The letters already had stamps on them, so the finder just had to put it in the letterbox. And this was considered by the researchers as a measure of altruism, because the finder had nothing to gain by posting the letter and was simply helping a stranger who had presumably dropped the letter accidentally. And the differences they found were quite dramatic. 87% of letters dropped in the richest neighbourhoods were posted, compared with 37% in the poorest neighbourhoods. So in that experiment, they were comparing classes and income levels. It would be interesting to see what the results would be comparing believers and atheists. My hunch would be that there would probably not be much difference, but it would be interesting to see those results. So, as atheists, I say let's just be honest and say to the Christians or Muslims or whoever we're debating with, yes, you're right, there may be a range of circumstances where there is no rational reason for us to be good. There's no God watching us and there's no rational reason to be altruistic. Yes. And yet, most atheists are good in those circumstances. Why? For the simple reason that they like being good. They want to be altruistic. It feels good to help others. So, as atheists, doesn't that make our altruistic acts somehow even more worthy, more moral somehow than those of believers? Because we were good even when we didn't need to be. Now, shouldn't we get extra brownie points for that somehow? Well, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, what can we conclude here? What's the moral of the story? Can we be good without God? Well, yes, obviously. Should we be good without God? Well, there may sometimes be rational reasons to be good. Yes, and sometimes there may not be. But even if there's no rational reason to be good, we generally act in a way that supports our mental well-being and validates our self-worth and feels right to us. We act according to our conscience. So maybe the real lesson to learn here is the importance of bringing up good children with good, altruistic, non-religious moral codes, with a conscience, with ethics, and with empathy, with a sense of fairness and justice. Because it seems that that's what determines whether you'll be good or not. Your upbringing. It's not religion that makes people good, and it's not rational thinking. It's how you were brought up. That determines what your conscience will tell you is right or wrong behavior. So bring up your children well, dear listener, whether you're a believer or an atheist. Oh, and of course it goes without saying that children should also be taught critical thinking as well and should be made to listen to every episode of Reality Check, obviously, so that they can grow up to become enlightened, well-informed, and ultimately good adults. Anyway, those are my opinions on the topic for what they're worth. If you'd like to send in your opinions or a comment or question on today's topic or an idea for a future topic, please send us an email. The address is realitychecktony@gmail.com, and that's Tony, T-O-N-Y. You can also visit our webpage too for past episodes of Reality Check. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie reviews.
Hi, this is Taylor Dane, and you're listening to Joy 94.9, Australia's first and only lesbian and gay radio station.
Melbourne's biggest gay voice has a fresh new sound.
Fresh new sound.
Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Try Sleeping With a Broken Heart by Alicia Keys. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the two movies up for review today are two recent American films, Bernie and Looper. Let's start with Bernie. Bernie is the latest offering from the incredibly prolific American filmmaker Richard Linklater. And surprisingly, it's a mix between black comedy and documentary. It tells the real-life story of a Texan mortician, Bernie Teedy, his arrival in the city of Carthage, Texas, his developing friendship with a wealthy elderly widow, and finally his murder of her and the subsequent trial. Now, the interesting thing about this movie is the way it interweaves scenes with Hollywood A-list actors, Jack Black, Matthew McConaughey, and Shirley MacLaine, with interviews with real-life residents of Carthage who were involved in various aspects of the case and the trial. But the director does it seamlessly, so sometimes it's hard to tell if someone's an actor or a real-life interviewee. That line is further blurred because in some scenes you even have some of the family members or other people from the real story actually acting in scenes with the Hollywood actors. I could only tell who was real and who was acting when the final credits rolled, featuring photos of all the participants in the movie and revealing what their role actually was. I've never seen a movie made quite like this before, and surprisingly, I have to say it comes together really well. And that's one thing I like about Richard Linklater as a director. I haven't always appreciated everything he's done over the years, but at least he's a director who's willing to have a go and experiment and try new and innovative ways of storytelling. In this case, I really think he pulled it off. Bernie is, in one word, a delight. And maybe the greatest revelation for me from this film is the acting skills of Jack Black. Now, I have to confess, I'd never actually seen Jack Black in a movie before. He tends to appear in those kinds of Hollywood studio comedies that we don't tend to review very much here on Reality Check. But in this movie, he's absolutely mesmerizing. Every time he's on the screen, I was captivated. And when he wasn't on the screen, I just wanted him to come back quickly. He's just amazing. He plays the title character of Bernie and hits just the right tone. The real-life Bernie was an unmarried, overweight man in his 30s who loved Broadway musicals and never showed any interest in women. So, many townspeople suspected he was gay. It's never made clear one way or the other in the film, and in the hands of a lesser actor, he could have been played overly camp, or could have just been turned into a screaming queen. But Jack Black hits just the right tone. Very measured, not camp exactly, just kind of enthusiastic. It's a wonder to behold. If he doesn't get the Academy Award for Best Actor at next year's Oscars, there is something seriously wrong. So that's Bernie, highly recommended by Reality Check, one of the best films I've seen this year. Okay, let's move on to our second film up for review this evening, and that's the new futuristic sci-fi time travel flick, Looper. Looper is the latest creation from the young, up-and-coming American director Rian Johnson. The setting is Kansas City in the year 2044, and the movie tells the story of Joe, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who works as a looper. Loopers are people who work for the mob, but the mob from 30 years further into the future, because by that time, 2074, time travel has been invented, and the mob, to erase all evidence of their murders, sends people they want knocked off back in time to 2044, where the loopers kill them and dispose of the bodies. The only hitch is that the loopers themselves will also be sent back in time from the year 2074 to be killed by their younger self. In other words, the loopers take on this well-paid job knowing that they've only got 30 years in which to live and spend all their ill-gotten cash. Anyway, I won't go too much into the plot. Needless to say, having to kill your older self when he suddenly appears in front of you is not exactly easy, and so leads to a series of complicated events that set the whole plot in motion. Now, as time travel movies are one of our favourite subgenres here on Reality Check, we just couldn't resist reviewing this latest addition to the oeuvre. Also, Looper has been very well received by critics with a score of 84% on Metacritic and 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. Plus, it stars Bruce Willis, who brings with him all the baggage of being in one of the greatest time travel movies of them all, 12 Monkeys. So, does Looper live up to the hype? Well, on the plus side, the film is certainly entertaining as it goes along and keeps you guessing as to what's going to happen next. That's one thing I really love in a movie, the feeling of unpredictability, of not knowing what's going to happen at any moment and being surprised by developments as they unfold. So the movie had that going for it, at least. Also, the concept of having your future self from 30 years into the future coming back and running around in your present is also an interesting premise. And there are some interesting time travel ideas thrown into the whole mix. For example, when the older version of Joe is running around in the year 2044, his memories of what he did in that year are forming at the same time that the younger Joe is actually living the experience. So kind of an interesting take on the whole time travel conundrum there. However, I'm sorry to say, dear listener, I think that overall Looper is a bit of a fizzer. For a plot with the potential to deal with some pretty profound existential issues, I found the whole story pretty insubstantial. I mean, it's fun for the 2 hours that it lasts, but it's pretty forgettable. And certainly not a film I'd want to see again, or that I found particularly thought-provoking. Which is a shame, because the one thing you can normally say about time travel movies is that they're almost always thought-provoking. Because the concept of time travel is full of paradoxes, so a good imaginative screenwriter has to find ways to get around them, or at least fudge them, and still retain some kind of internal logic with whatever approach to time travel that he or she decides to take. But Looper wasn't particularly interesting in that way, and even in terms of its own internal logic, it still seemed to leave some huge holes in the plot. The time travel loops just didn't really make much sense. In fact, even though I know that Rian Johnson spent years developing the script, it seemed kind of contrived and, well, undeveloped and still needing a lot of work. Also, the characters are not very appealing and don't really develop along the way. And there's also a lot of gratuitous violence, which is just kind of irritating. And then there are some parts of the movie that are just a bit ridiculous. For example, the film very early on introduces the idea that 10% of the population has telekinetic powers. Now, this is obviously a setup for some plot points later in the script, but I just found it to be a bit silly. I mean, really? Did the scriptwriter really just have to throw in magic like that for the script to work? I mean, just go and say, oh yeah, by the way, it's the future, and also, let's just say that 10% of the people have telekinesis, okay? Is that cool? Yeah, well, not really. It's kind of silly, actually. Just because it's the future doesn't mean people are going to develop telekinesis, because telekinesis is, well, not possible, actually. And also, some of the direction and editing choices that Rian Johnson makes are kind of a bit clumsy. I mean, the film is very tense, especially when we realize how sadistic and brutal the bad guys are. So there's a constant gnawing fear in the pit of your stomach because the stakes are really high. And yet the director seems to set up sequences that could be really tense and scary, but then kind of ends them too soon, or jumps to the reveal too quickly, or lets them dissipate. It's quite frustrating. So overall, Looper is not a bad Friday night kind of popcorn flick, and it's quite fun as it goes along, but unfortunately I don't think it's going to change movie history, or enter the canon of the great time travel movies of the ages. So, diverting and entertaining, but ultimately a bit pointless. And that brings us to the end of the 57th episode of Reality Check. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And visit our website to subscribe to the podcast. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll be back with the next episode sometime in the coming weeks.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.